sure we know the tropes are going to be similar, mm-hmm. but the themes, the butter, the, mm-hmm. the tap into your id are there for both. That we as humans crave certain things, and the time period isn't what determines what we crave. It's mm-hmm. our own, you know, personal psyche and how authors meet that mm-hmm. and how that comes about is by trope and by genre, but they're fundamentally still the same thing. So how mm-hmm. do I get people to realize that and take a chance?
Welcome to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast, where we focus on how authors found success, looking at strategies that have taken them to the top of the bestseller charts, as well as what they've learned from their mistakes. Because being an indie author is more than knowing the latest marketing trend. It's about being innovative and creative and learning from your mistakes.
Welcome to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast. I'm Sarah Rosette.
And I'm Jamie Albright. And this week on the show, we have
Celeste Barclay.
Yes, we do. And y'all, it's so good. I love Celeste. She's just kind of incredible in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I'm kind of in awe of her every time she speaks. We're in a morning group together, and I just learned so much from her. I say we're in a morning group. She's on the East Coast. And so when she has to get up to get in the group, it's very early.
It is morning for her.
Yeah. Sometimes she doesn't make it, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, so, we had a great time talking with her and talked about binge writing and the power of universal themes and pulling in readers to new genres. She had some very interesting comparisons between genres that you wouldn't think mm-hmm. were similar. Mm-hmm. She's using Theodora Taylor's universal fantasy mm-hmm. kind of those things that appeal across genre mm-hmm. in her marketing. So mm-hmm. it was really interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. So what's been going on with you?
Well, I am down to the last scene in my book. I'm working on it. So I dictated it earlier this week, and we've had a whole bunch of podcasts, so I didn't really get to work on it. We are working ahead for this summer, and we're killing ourselves. Jamie's like, are we done yet? Are we done yet?
Even I am experiencing some social fatigue.
Yes, yeah. And Jamie's much more a people person than I am. So we're having a great time once we get going with the interviews. But like scheduling them and looking at the calendar and going, oh my goodness, we've got a lot going on. So not as much writing has been done this week, but I am editing the mm-hmm. last scene, which feels really good, even though I know so much work to do.
Yeah.
So, I know, but so, still, so much
that's such a great feeling.
Yes, awesome. It is. It is. And I feel like I've spent the first couple months of the year working on this. Mm-hmm. Then once I get the draft done, I'll take a break and do some other things mm-hmm. as I'm revising. So, yay.
Yeah.
That's all I can say right now.
Yeah, I know.
So what about you? What have you got going?
Well, still writing. Every morning I get up and write. And thank you, Erica and Deanna, for holding me accountable. I'm also getting things together for this rebranding release on May 6th and the novella release. And it's a lot, y'all. It's a lot. I had forgotten.
Had you forgotten?
I'd forgotten.
It's all coming back to you now, though, right?
It's all coming back to me, and I'm doing it by myself. I mean, Adriel is helping me. I'm transitioning my newsletter from MailChimp to MailerLite, and she's helping me with that. But other than that, I'm doing it all by myself. And I had forgotten. Plus, I'm speaking at the Oklahoma Writers Federation next week.
So what day will that be?
Their conference, the fourth, and fifth.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm doing two talks, one on how to build a newsletter with readers who will buy your books. Mm-hmm. And the second one is the do's and don'ts of writing funny, which the newsletter talk I've done before. There are just a few things I have to, you know, confirm on that mm-hmm. one, just to make sure I've got my facts straight as far as, you know, what each platform does and everything. But the funny talk I'm having to write from scratch.
And, so, and that's not fun, right?
It's not fun, funny, y'all.
But it'll be
not fun.
Yeah.
But
it will
no.
be funny when you get done.
I don't know.
It will be.
Hopefully it'll be informative. Let's just go with that. Hopefully it will be informative. But I don't really think I'm qualified to teach somebody how to write funny, but I do think I'm qualified to teach them what you do and don't do, especially the don'ts. Because I've done all of them well, and messed up. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. So I think that'll
all
be
of your
good.
Books have humor, right? Mm-hmm. All of your books have humor. So, yeah. And you have a funny outlook on life, even when things are not going real well.
Yeah.
You usually see the humor in the situation. And I think that you probably have a lot to say on that.
Oh, well,
really
we'll
valuable
see.
Insights.
We'll see. So I've been working, I mean, like just crazy. Today's Friday. And so I wrote this morning online with my friends and then got off and started working on that talk. And I worked on it all day because, you know, I want to have some examples and that's what's tricky, you know, finding good examples that aren't offensive to a wide audience. That's hard, you know, that's hard. And I'm just doing that. Yeah. So, and then the novella real quick, my novella that I'm putting out, I wrote an epilogue for it and remembered that 3 years ago, that novella was on Read Me Romance, which Read Me Romance is a podcast where they take short stories or novella, really short novellas, and make them into audiobooks. And then over two episodes, they play the audiobook and they get professional narrators and stuff. And the narrator that they got for my book was great. Mm-hmm. And after a year, I bought it back, but I've never done anything with it. I was going to give it away for free to build an audiobook newsletter, but I just never did that. And so I remembered that I had it. So I reached out to the narrator they used to see if she could redo the intro and outro because I changed the name of the book and also record the epilogue. And she said she could. And they did it in a week. She recorded it. They produced it. I got it today. So I am going to, I'm putting that in the novella, in the front and the back, kind of. You can buy it from me if you want if you also want the audio book, you can buy it from me and I'm going to do a pay hit thing and put it on BookFunnel. So
yeah, nice.
I'm pretty excited. You know, we'll see what happens. I don't know if people will buy it or not, but it'll be a nice little easy step into
direct sales.
Yeah. Direct sales. Yeah. So, you know, at least when we have people on and talking about, I know what they're talking about.
Are you going to use a QR code in the book, in the print? In the, I guess it would only, you'd only use that for print. And this is going to be more digital. Yeah.
So yeah. This will just be a digital. It'll just be a link. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't confuse me, Sarah.
I'm sorry.
I don't really know what I'm doing.
QR codes for print later. We'll do that later.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm doing. And I'm really, you know, I'm feeling excited. I've reached out to some Instagrammers about, you know, posting about the rebrand and the novella, and I've had some really great response, and I'm reaching out to all my friends, and I'm not above asking people on this podcast, if you write what I write, please, please, please post about it. So anyway, that's what's going on with me.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
I feel like you've gone from like maybe like 20 to 60, like with your writing. I feel like now you're really back in it because you were chugging along, but now I feel like you're like really, really going for it.
I'm doing a lot of busy work. I mean, you know, it's a lot of work.
It is.
I don't know how much more writing I'm doing, but I'm doing the stuff that gets the book out. Yeah. So, you know,
and that's part of the process.
Yeah. It's part of the process.
Got to be done. Somebody's got to do it.
Oh, no.
Those books don't get out. Okay, so we've got some supporters.
Yay!
So we have new supporters. So we've got Nora Michaels, and she chose the unicorn emoji. And then we have two magnifying glass people, Ashley Admire and Aggie.
So thank you so much, guys. Yeah, we really appreciate our supporters so much. And means a lot to us. I say that every week, but
it really does.
It keeps us going. It encourages us.
Yeah. Lets us know that you're interested in the podcast and want us to keep doing it. So thank you.
Yep.
If you want to support the podcast, you can go to wishidknownforwriters.com/support. All right. So we should get on with Celeste.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, today we're really excited to have Celeste Barclay with us. Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, we're so excited.
We are.
We can't wait. Yeah,
we are. So here's Celeste's bio. Celeste Barclay tumbled into publishing 6 years ago and is now the author of over 50 books across two pen names. Celeste pens historical romance as Celeste and mafia romance as Sabine Barclay. When she isn't furiously typing away, she enjoys the Southern California sunshine.
So jealous. Even though we get sunshine, it's not the same thing.
It's not the same.
No, it's not the same. So tell us how you got into writing.
I kind of tumbled into it arse backwards, for lack of a better way to put it. I always say, you know, I'm not a particularly whimsical person, but I did this on a whim, and I did. I had an idea for a book and a story, or a series rather, and I just kind of one day said, well, let's see. So let's start writing. You've taught literature, you've taught composition. All right, let's have a go. And I did. And then I went, well, now what? Because I have... For two things, I have a fear of rejection, so I didn't want to query because I figured if it was no good, that just nobody would buy it, and I didn't need somebody to send me a rejection letter. Right. I also figured that if I was going to fall flat on my face, I was going to do it privately. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was on the down low for quite some time before I told anybody at all.
Yeah.
What I was doing. And so, you know, I put up my first book and didn't know what I was doing, but a couple of people bought it. So I was like, all right, well, I'm already writing the second book. Let's go ahead and put that up. And then between the second and the third book, I went, well, now I really need to figure this out, because if I'm going to keep writing these books and I want to actually get them into the world and hopefully have people enjoy them, then I got to learn this business. So between books two and three, I really studied the industry, learned as much as I could, and revamped the way that I launched books, you know, got over my fear of spending money on covers, got proper covers, and went for it. And it just took off from there.
And, that's great. You know,
I left teaching and now I'm a full-time author. So I stumbled into it like, you know, arse backwards, head over heels, through the bush, whatever you want to say. It was not with the usual plan and strategy and methodicalness that I usually do things.
Yeah. Well, now, when was that when you put your first book out?
So actually, I just hit my sixth publishing anniversary 2 days
very
ago.
Good. So very good.
April 15th. I always say it's better than celebrating tax day.
Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, I just passed my seventh and hey. I never remember until after the fact, but yeah, I just passed my seventh. So yeah. But
you're so busy. We're so busy writing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm so busy.
Just fly right by.
But well, that's amazing. I love that story. That's really great.
Yeah. Now, was that historical fiction?
Historical romance. Yeah.
Okay.
I started out as a really avid historical fiction reader. You know, as a kid, I grew up reading the classics. So to me, they were historical fiction, more contemporary at one point. Mm-hmm. And it just, one day I came across a historical romance and I was like, this looks good. Let me give it a go. And quite a lot later, I decided, you know, I want to write this. Let's see what happens with it. So it was just kind of a natural progression for me to go from reading historical fiction to historical romance and being like, oh, look, there's a happily ever after. There's no guarantee of that in regular historical fiction.
But
this is in romance.
Right.
Kind of feels good.
Yeah. Feels good.
Yeah. Which can be the other, like, just historical fiction or literary fiction. If you're reading, like, that can be very depressing. So I can see why I'd be like, yay, let's have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what is your definition of success?
You know, I asked that question early on in my career. And of course, I got the, well, it's subjective. It's different. Everybody. And I was like, no, it's not. I need to know, like, at what point should I expect to break even? At what point should I see, you know, some sales taking off?
Right.
For me, the measure, the first measure of success, the first mark that I was succeeding was seeing a progressive climb in my sales, that each book was drawing in more readers, more sales, that I was recouping the investments faster and faster as far as the cover and the editing was concerned. So to me, that was the first mark of success, was when my bottom line actually was a line and not just a money pit. And that was very quick. You know, it really truly was, because I spent so much time between book two and book three learning the business, that book three was that first mark of success. The next mark of success was a year and a half in. I had already, you know, been equaling my teacher salary. And I was able to say, thank you, no, thank you. I'm done. I've spent 16 years as an educator, and it's the right time for me to move on. So that was sort of the next mark of success. Another one was when I launched the second brand. Another one was when I became president of Ninc. So there's no conclusive way to say what success is, but to me, it is not ambiguous and amorphous. I think there are some commonalities of you're succeeding when you're making some money.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're in the black and not in the red, that's the first mark of success.
Yeah. I agree. That's funny. I kept wanting this. I wanted the same thing in the beginning. I was like, what's a good rank? Cause I had one, but I didn't know I had one. I'd never done this before. So yeah. But I was like, somebody give me some markers. I need to know. But it's hard. It's hard in this business. So being
as a former educator, I like benchmarks. Yes. I like to know when I'm hitting.
Right. Exactly. Well, speaking of being a former educator and English teacher or English
company? Social studies is how I started. And because of that, I tumbled into English, but I don't have a degree in English. I haven't taken a creative writing class since I was in junior high. Yeah. So I taught both, but primarily I was a social studies teacher first and foremost.
Okay. Well, this doesn't make me feel so silly asking it then. What do you wish you'd known about writing and craft when you started?
You know, I am a pantser, and I can dissect other people's work. I can dissect my own work and break it down into pieces, but I have a very hard time being able to tell people, oh, this is where the inciting incident starts. This is where act one ends. This is where act two ends. This is this, this is that. And so I've had to learn to get better at communicating that to other people, like my editor, agent, like that, because it is very difficult for me as somebody who does not plot in depth. I have a kind of an overall idea of the story arc. Being able to communicate that to other people in advance of writing it has really been something I've had to learn how to do. And I still struggle with that because I just don't know far enough ahead what it's going to be, but other people want to know.
Yeah.
You're like, just trust me.
Yeah, we'll get there. You should know by now. Yeah.
But no, I still struggle with that.
Yeah.
What about marketing? What do you wish you'd known about marketing?
So the very first thing that I wish that I had realized was I launched a successful Highlander romance series. And in my head, as a reader, it wasn't a far leap to go from Highlanders to Vikings. So I decided I wanted to do a Viking series as my next one. I did not study the market and the readership well enough to understand that that is not the same easy jump for other people as it was for me, mm-hmm. and that it's an even smaller niche. And now my Viking series does extremely well, but I'm established and people know me. But it not doing that research ahead of time and making an assumption and projecting my interests on my consumers did mean that I took a dip and I had to do some rebuilding by the time that series was over. And I love that series now, but when I was writing it, I was kind of like, okay, we need to be done. We need to move back into Highlanders and get things back on train. And once I'm there, then I can go back and push these Vikings. But it was projecting my own beliefs and my own consumer behavior on my readership and not learning them. So that was the very first thing in marketing that was like, you need to wake up and take this seriously.
Yeah, that's so interesting because like historical mystery is the same way. There are people who will only read World War II books, or they'll mm-hmm. only read Victorian, or they'll only read ancient history. And they don't really go back and forth. I mean, you'd think it wouldn't be that big a leap to go from Victorian to 1920s but the books are completely different. So yeah. That's something that, and people are very loyal to their, what they like, and they're oftentimes really not interested in, you know.
That's a diplomatic way of putting it. Yes.
They're loyal.
Yeah, no, that is a nice way of putting it. They like what they like and they don't like anything else.
Yeah, they're just not interested. Yeah, that's funny.
You need to ask the next question. Pug is losing his mind and I don't know why.
Okay, we'll do that then. All right, so what assumptions did you make at the beginning of your writing career, and looking back, did they turn out to be right or wrong?
You know, that first one that I just told you guys about that I made was a big one. And it sort of stopped me in my tracks and told me, stop assuming things. Because you know what happens when you assume. And it made me really think, okay, what have I learned about the industry so far? What skills do I bring over? Because I do have a background in political management, which is basically PR, which is basically marketing. There's a lot of overlapping, mm-hmm. Concepts there. So I needed to stop and pull from that knowledge I already have, figure out how it was transferable and apply it. And so when I stopped making those assumptions, life did get a lot easier for me. And I do believe that the success that I have experienced, that I want to keep experiencing, comes from the fact that I try not to assume too much. I think it's inevitable that I do, that we all do, mm-hmm. you know, but I do try very hard to base it on qualitative and quantitative observations, that I believe in the scientific method. If I'm going to change something, I'm only changing one variable at a time, so that I don't make assumptions and fall on my face, because, you know, that's expensive.
It's very expensive. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It is expensive. That's for sure. But you learn fast too. You know, when the stakes are like that, you learn real fast and you change. Yeah. You learn to pivot. That's for sure. Well, what's the most important lesson you've learned?
Oh, you got to be flexible. You got to be able to bend with the wind or you will snap. You have to be willing to accept that this is a very unpredictable, sometimes volatile industry to be in, and that you've got to be willing to sway and bend with that wind. If you are, you know, dead set on things being an absolute, that may not work out so well for you. So just being prepared to adapt and being flexible with things and looking for opportunities and seizing them when I can after vetting them, but also realizing that it's okay to walk away from things mm-hmm. that seemed like a good opportunity, but they don't fit your brand. They don't fit the timing. They don't fit your right. goals, whatever it is. But that would be the biggest lesson that I have learned, is just to be flexible in this industry.
A very good lesson.
That leads, that leads perfectly into the next question, which is, what's the biggest change you've had to make in your thinking? Can you think of anything that, like, you were doing something and then you had to change and kind of change track?
Yes. I would say that one of the things that I've really had to stop and evaluate and really consider what path I'm taking forward is that we do have a changing demographic in historical romance, you know, looking at age of readership. And mm-hmm. that if I continue to market solely the way that I have, I'm going to run out of readers. There's not a diplomatic way that, like, you know, I will run out. So yeah. just rethinking how I want to market to two different audiences to try and start bringing in newer, younger readers. And it's, I believe that I write stories, you know, that my readership already enjoys and they keep coming back for, but I also write stories that other readerships would like and enjoy and that meet their expectations, but they got to find out about it. And so mm-hmm. I need to, you know, I've had to rethink that and rethink about how to market to two different audiences when it's the same product.
Mm-hmm. So you have your established readers that you know how to reach them. And now you're coming up with new ways to reach younger audiences.
Yeah. You know, and I, to toot my own horn, gave a presentation on this, Ed. But, you know, how to keep your cash cow without, you know, losing them while you're putting together your designer dog. And that's just, you know, how do I keep the money coming in while I'm piecing together the people that I really want to start buying my books, you know? So just how do you balance that? And really the biggest lesson, you know, in the broadest scope is, you are still marketing the same product, but you don't have to say the same thing to two different people.
So
figuring out what it is to say is important, but it doesn't have to be the same thing to everybody.
Yeah. So I bet your PR background comes in helpful there.
It does. I mean, I tell people, if I can get somebody to vote for a candidate or vote on legislation, I can get them to buy a book. So buying the book
is harder. The book is easy, probably.
No, the book is harder.
Is it harder?
Yes. Okay. It is. But, you know, if I can, you know, work my skills of persuasion for that, then I should be able to sell a book.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
So if you were starting over today, what would you do differently?
So I was thinking about that. And what I would say is I would better understand what I was committing to when I started in KU. Mm. And I just did not fully understand all the things that went along with the different platforms and then what that exclusivity meant and what it would look like. And I don't regret being a KU author. You know, I've built a very good, lucrative career on that. But I wish I had understood better, because I might have taken a different path. I might have gone wide from the beginning. But again, I didn't fully understand the industry. I didn't understand the readership and their behaviors to make a fully educated decision that early on, because I'm not somebody who planned on writing this book for a long time and who studied the industry beforehand and had this whole plan going into it. Like, it was more of, I got this, now what am I going to do?
Right.
And so the resources that I had 6 years ago that really, truly did help me launch my career were heavily, you know, invested in pro KU, and that's fine. But I just wish that I had understood better, because I made an informed decision. I didn't make an educated decision. Right. And I do think that there's a difference between the two.
Right. Yeah. Like, I did study like the business, so I knew some things, but I agree with you. Like, I assumed that if non-KU readers would buy my books. And I will say that in the beginning, I did have a lot more sales than other KU authors that I knew. But that has definitely changed. Like, definitely changed. So yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's, I still don't know that I would have done it any differently, but I would have liked to have had, I would have liked to have known that, that there are just some readers that aren't going to cross over. And, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's backtrack and go back to writing historical romance. And what do you, or is there anything you wish you had known about writing historical romance other than like the loyalty of the readers to their specific type of book that they like? Is there anything else about historical romance?
I think understanding the different segments within that, and not just subgenres, but, you know, fully understanding how many people are going to lean towards steamy, how many are going to lean towards clean. I'm very steamy. Like, part of the reason why I have a pen name is because when I did start writing, I taught middle school, and what I write is absolutely positively, utterly inappropriate for children. So I wanted to separate those two things. But just understanding that, and I'm happy I lean very steamy. It's worked very well for me. I enjoy writing and reading it. But, you know, understanding that, understanding that medieval is a smaller subgenre of historical romance, things along those lines. But I read a lot of it before I got started. So from a craft side, I feel like I was pretty knowledgeable going into it. I'd read so many of these that I'd internalized the story arc pretty deeply. And so now it's pretty intuitive. I have my own spin on things, and I do write stories a little bit differently than most. You know, my couples get together a bit sooner, and it's very us against the world. It's not waiting until the last chapter. There's no third act breakup. So it is a little different from that point of view, but just, again, understanding the size of the market, and the things that they want, what their thresholds are. Steamy readers will read down in heat, but clean readers will not read up in heat. So understanding things like that, but from a craft side, I really do feel like I internalized a lot from the amount of reading that I did that has made it intuitive to me on a lot of levels.
Yeah. Same. Because I had no idea about writing a book, how to write a book, you know. So a lot of what I learned, I mean, I learned from other people too. But yeah, I think that happens to a lot of us. It just, for some people, it happens a lot younger. Did you read as a child? A lot?
I did. I did read a lot as a kid. I'm an only child. And for some reason, people think giving board games to an only child is a good idea. So I have a lot. And perhaps that's where my strategic mind comes from, because I will beat you at Monopoly, because I had plenty of time to figure out how to do that on my own. But it did mean that I read, a lot. I grew up in the Midwest. We have winter for reals. You know, and I traveled a lot as a kid. You know, we're an international family. So back in the day, there was only one movie screen in the airplane. There was no picking what you wanted.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're in the clouds and it's dark and you're doing an overnight transatlantic flight, like, you need something to do. So I had a walk in a book. So I did read a lot as a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That makes sense.
That's great. Yeah, it does. Well, what's the biggest jump or change in your thinking you've had to make for writing in two genres, two completely different genres? I mean, one's historical romance, the other's mafia romance, right?
You know, the thing is that the reason why I fell for mafia romance so quickly, because I have a friend who wrote historical. She wrote a mafia book that was part of a multi-author project. Uh-huh. I didn't realize that. I read her book. I went to see if she had more, discovered that it was part of a map. And I read that, those other ones, and really liked them. And it just was a snowball from there.
Yeah.
But I realized very, very quickly at the heart of it, they are the same. And that's why I gravitated towards them. you know, if you like swords and kilts, you'll love guns and suits. If you love guns and suits, you'll love swords and kilts, because at the heart of it, it is about that nuclear family, be it chosen or by blood, a clan or a syndicate. It's alpha men protecting their families, protecting the women they love. It's independent heroines who have to be able to fend for themselves when they're, you know, their menfolk are out and about. At the heart of it, it's always love, loyalty, duty, and honor. So it is Joanna Shoup gave an interview a while ago, and she does write, I believe it's mafia, or at least dark under a pen name. And I did not know that, but she said, you know, mafia romance is just medieval romance today. And that's what it is. Really? So trying to get readers of those two different demographics to understand, you know, yeah, you might be trading a horse for a Bugatti or a Bugatti for a horse.
Right.
Still me. I'm still the same storyteller. You're still going to get the same themes and feelings, and that they are way more related than you realize. But some people are easy to convince and others not so much. My established readership is historical. And so they've been willing to come over because they know me already. But my younger mafia readers, I'm having people cross over, but it's definitely slower going, convincing them to read, you know, books from the 14th century versus, you know, my historical readers who don't mind reading something nowadays, but they overlap a lot in trying to inform or educate readers of that.
Wow. So okay. Interesting. That is so interesting. Yeah. And now we got to figure out a way to let those younger readers know they're not bodice rippers. They're, you know, it's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, in both my medievals and my contemporaries, I do write very independent heroines. And I do love me a good dark romance. I don't mind, you know, some Stockholm syndrome when I'm reading, but that's not my natural story telling rhythm. So that's not the dynamic with my couples and my mafia romances and with medieval. You know, honestly, if you were, you know, a noble woman and your husband rode out to battle and you had no idea if he was coming back and you were responsible for all of the clan, you had to be pretty darn self-sufficient and resourceful and independent. And so to me, they lend themselves very parallel. So getting younger readers to understand that, you know, my heroines in my medieval are not all damsels in distress in living through misogyny and patriarchy, and they are not under anybody's thumb.
Right.
They're pretty kick-ass.
That's tough, though. Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
Also, the us against the world theme, I think, probably does translate to the mafia romance, too. I mean, I don't read mafia romance, but the ones I've, you know, heard about or read the description, it's always somebody in it. There's a reason they, you know, of course, they can't be together, and then they get together, and then everybody's against them because they're together or something. So,
you know, whether it's the larger idea of the syndicate or the clan, or whether it's the couple specifically, I really like writing us versus the world, or us against
that. Yeah.
So I think that makes me think of Theodora Taylor's Universal Fantasies. It's like you're talking beyond just this narrow thing. You're making a connection between the clan and the syndicate, so that somebody who likes one or the other might go, oh, it's just this in a different time period. Right. And that might pull them over. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really trying to show, you know, that, yeah, sure, we know the tropes are going to be similar, but the themes, the butter, the to tap into your id are there for both. That we as humans crave certain things, and the time period isn't what determines what we crave. It's our own, you know, personal psyche and how authors meet that. And how that comes about is by trope and by genre, but they're fundamentally still the same thing. So how do I get people to realize that and take a chance?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we also talked to you a little bit before we started recording about direct sales. And you said you don't have a store, but you do sell signed paperbacks through your website. So tell us a little bit about that, because that's kind of a different way to do direct sales than like setting up the whole Shopify store.
So I just hit my sixth publishing anniversary this week, and very early on, I realized that I did have the potential to make more money off of paperbacks than just having them on, you know, the retailers, you know, just Amazon or adding on Barnes and Noble, things like that. I knew that I wanted to start getting into merchandise as well. So I really, you know, asked my readers in my group. I did a Facebook Live getting ideas of what type of merch they would like and things along those lines. So through Equid and my WordPress site, I do have a store on there, but I will admit that it is not a top priority of mine. I really don't push the merch much anymore. But the paperbacks I do, and letting people know that they can order autographed paperbacks, at least on the Celeste side. I haven't set up anything for Sabine yet because I've been a little busy. letting them know, you know, you can bundle and get a discount by buying, you know, more than one book, that you'll get them autographed. And you know, it is a great source of extra money. You know, I do upcharge because I am there to make a profit. And, you know, when I push it, I see orders. When I don't push it, I don't see orders.
Right.
I have enough books on hand at home to fulfill those orders, as well as to be prepared for the various signings I do. Mm-hmm. So it's not such a massive quantity that it's unmanageable for me to do it myself. Mm-hmm. So right now it works really well, but my audio is through a publisher. My ebooks are through a small house. So the only, you know, medium that I have a lot of control and freedom is my paperbacks. Mm-hmm. And it's super simple. In the US, I use Media Mail. I drop the books in there. It's cheap. And, you know, I factor in postage into the pricing. If I do, I've had a couple of international orders, and then I will price it and invoice them again for postage because it is a lot more. But it's been very simple. And I've had this store since the very beginning. It could do with a facelift. Definitely could do with a facelift. But I started this 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like it works though. So it doesn't sound like you really need to do anything to change it. If you're, because do you promote it in like your newsletter and on social media?
I should promote it more. It's not something that I bring up in conversation nearly as often as I should. So that is one of those things that I'm like, all right, I need to work this into, you know, a newsletter at least once a month, once every 2 months. I should probably have a social media post about it here and there. So things to just kind of pull back into the forefront of my mind.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, it's my kind of store because, you know, direct sales light. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think it's for those of us who just do not have the bandwidth to set up like the whole shebang, and then this is a good alternative. So I love that that we have that option and opportunity. So I know that you are a binge writer. So tell us about that, and tell us how many books you try to put out every year.
Well, let's start with that latter question. I only put out 6 books a year, and sometimes it ends up being 14. So, you know, when you decide that you want to launch a new pen name and you're in KU and it behooves you to write long, sometimes you wind up more books in a year than you expected. Right. So what I try to do and what ends up happening are usually the reverse for me.
Yes. Yeah.
But I learned in college that when I tried to start term papers early and do a little bit here and there and not procrastinate, my grade was generally not so wonderful. And I realized after doing that about 3 times in college and being like, oh, damn, I can't afford to do this, it was because my voice changed. My line of thought changed when I these days, even sometimes weeks in between writing sessions, wow. and I lost continuity. Mm-hmm. So for me, I have found, you know, in college, in grad school, the procrastinating, maybe I shouldn't have waited until the night before, but doing it in one sitting really ensured that for me, the quality was better because there was consistency of train of thought, of voice. And so it's that way for me now as a novelist. You know, part of it is my imagination is pretty damn awesome, and I really like living in it more than I do reality. It's a much happier place to be. So I don't mind spending many hours there. But also, you know, from a more craft side of it, that when I do binge write and I write many hours at a time and I write sessions very close together, it ensures that I produce a very clean copy the first go around because I am not having these long gaps where I have to go back and put myself back into the story. I'm a very linear writer. I don't move scenes around. I don't write out of order. I might have ideas for scenes that are not chronological and I want to get to there. But when I write, it is start to finish. And right. you know, I've learned to reread the previous days or previous writing sessions work to really make sure it's clean. But you know, when I write pretty much every day, maybe take weekends off or a couple of weekdays here and there if I'm busy and I'm just away from the computer. But if I, you know, sit down and write a book in a month, you know, that is slow for me. Because I have pushed myself before when I wanted to grow my backlist to write, you know, 75 to 100 in 2 weeks. And that just, it's sustainable because if I tell myself to do it, I'm going to do it. Like, right. that's just the way it is, but it's not what I want to sustain. So yeah. now, yeah. you know, it does take me a month, maybe 6 weeks at the longest to write a book. But it's because I am very immersive. I am a binge yeah. writer.
Yeah.
And then do you have, like, you'll do that, and then do you have some time where you're not writing drafts, your first draft? Are you doing other things?
So when I have a single-digit publication yeah. here, then yes, I do try to take at least a couple weeks off with juggling two pen names for the past 2 years, it really was prohibitive for me to be able to do that. You know, I would have a week or two off and then I needed to jump into the next one. Celeste brand is slowing down a little bit. That brand is only going to have two books this year, and Sabine is going to have at least six because that's just where the growing market is. So that does make it a little bit easier for me to take some time in between, but not a whole lot. And I'm okay with that. I really am. Like, I've had years where I've been able to take, you know, like 6 weeks off in between projects, and that's been great. And then I have years where I only take a couple weeks off or even just a couple of days off. And that's fine because that's just where I am. That's what fits with what I need, you know, psychologically, right. monetarily, whatever it is. That's just, you know, the place that I'm at.
Well, I love that because you're doing what works for you yes. instead of being like, oh, I have to write every day or I have to do it this way. We would all be so much happier if we would just do what works. I
will say, especially to anybody new out there, one thing that really chaps my keister is that idea that I'm trying, you know,
we appreciate it. Thank you.
Our editor does too.
Really chaps my keister is this notion that I think a lot of newer authors hear, oh, you have to write every day. Yeah. You know, that's the only way you're really going to hone your craft. That's what makes you an author. BS. Yeah. Have you ever seen somebody go to a lawyer and say, well, you're not in court every day, so you're not really a lawyer?
Right.
Or go to a physician and say, well, you know, you're not doing an appendectomy every day, so you're not really a doctor. I don't like that. a write at your speed, write at your pace, do what works for you creatively, fiscally, whatever it is, but don't feel forced into that notion that to be a real author, you have to write every day. We are not Hemingway. We're not bleeding on a typewriter with our whiskey next to us, unless that's, you know, how you choose. You do you, boo. So that is the one thing that does irritate me when newer authors feel compelled to have to write every day. No, you don't.
Well, I woke up Monday and I was very tired. I had been gone all weekend and I was just super tired. And I have a thing that I get on at 8 o'clock. Well, we do our call at 7 for Clubhouse. And then at 8, I get on and write. Well, they couldn't be there. And I was like, oh, this is going to be hard to do by myself. And then I thought, you know what? I don't have to do it if I don't think I feel like it. And so I just sat for a little bit and thought, what is today? And I just decided today was a rest day. And I rested all day. And I didn't feel guilty about it. And but I've had to teach myself to do that. And it's very hard, because not just because of this industry, but I think our culture, we're not a resting culture.
Yeah, and so not working 8 to 5, 5 days a week, or whatever.
One of the hardest things when I transitioned to writing as my sole profession, because I work from home, and you know, at the time both of my teenage boys lived at home, one of them's in college, my husband, if we weren't doing things together and I was chilling on my own, it was kind of always like, well, I'm not doing something else and my computer's there, why don't I just get a little bit of stuff done? And I had to set some boundaries with myself and say, it's okay to close up shop and be done for the day or take the weekend off. That's what normal people do with other jobs. And it's okay to do that. And I always joke that, you know, my boss is a real bee. She can be such a but she's great about, you know, giving me all the paid time off I want. You know, I have the luxury of, you know, or the privilege of being able to say, you know what, today is not a writing day, or today is not a business day, today is not an anything day. I've, you know, real life stuff to do, or I just want to chill out and watch a whole bunch of episodes of Real Housewives.
Right.
I can do that. And that is one of the great things about this profession. And it's one of the reasons why I can honestly say there's never a day I don't like having this job. There's never a day where I wake up and I go, oh, this again. Like, there's no Sunday where I'm like gearing myself up for the week. It's just kind of like, it is Sunday.
That, oh my goodness, I have to get up and go to work on Monday. I don't feel that either. And that's such a relief. And so we need to let go of all the guilt we feel.
Yes.
Or like not doing X or Y. Because even like my husband travels a lot. And when he's had a trip, when he comes home, we decided that next day is his recovery day. That's his get reacclimated, do whatever you need to do, rest up. And that's totally fine. And it's totally fine if we do that for ourselves. We can let ourselves have the afternoon off.
Right. You know, well, I, you know, I came up with a couple of ideas for my story on that day that I was resting, because I was resting. I mean, I wasn't in bed all day, but I just rested. I did the things that make me feel rested. And I don't feel bad about it. I know. I feel really good that I don't feel bad about it, which in the past I would have felt really guilty. About what? I mean, that's the thing. Like, we work for ourselves. So, anyway, but I appreciate the way you do it. And I think that we all need, I appreciate what you said about we all have our ways of doing it. And,
absolutely. You know, there's certain things that are absolute, you know, writing process. There's some form of brainstorming. There's some form of drafting. There's some form of revising and editing. And then there's publishing.
Yeah,
that's the writing process. That's what I taught for years. But how long each step is varies. The little offshoots and side streets to that road meander, and they're different for everybody.
Right.
The commonality is you've got to come up with an idea. You've got to write it. You've got to clean it up. You got to put it out there. That's the only thing that's finite and absolute in this. The rest of it, you know,
Right.
You do you, boo. That's what it is a lot.
Yeah, that's right. 100%. Yeah. Well, what's the best thing you've done to set yourself up for success?
It's my work ethic. Yeah. I don't have another way of explaining that other than the fact that I am a very internally motivated person. I do have 2 graduate degrees that I did while I had little kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say that I incubated and hatched one of them during my first degree, and I had a toddler already. So I learned that I had a very finite amount of time. You know, a nap time I had at night. When I did my second degree, I was teaching full time. So I would work on my homework from 8 to 11, 8 to midnight every night. It wasn't a question of whether or not I wanted to or not. It had to get done. I had to do a really good job because I only had so much time. And so that's kind of translated over, you know, as an educator. Yes, I have time to lesson plan, but I only have so much time to teach and make right. sure people right. understand. And so with that has translated over to me, you know, being capable and compelled to do a very clean draft the first go around. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I graduated early from high school, graduated early from college, graduated early from one of my grad school programs, because apparently patience is not one of my virtues, but I do excel at things because I work really hard. Yeah. Some stuff is a blessing and it comes to me easily. Other stuff is definitely laborious, but it's my work ethic. Yeah. I work until things are done, and it doesn't really matter whether or not I wanna or not.
Like, you just do. Yeah. I love that. I think that's great. And I think that we've got to have people like you to make the world go round. Cause let me tell you, if they were all like me, we'd still be resting and we would hit it.
Not a bad thing. We need all sorts to make the world better.
Well, it's been great having you on the podcast today. Tell people where they can find out more about you and your books.
Well, the easiest way to do it is to go to CelesteBarkley.com or SabineBarkley.com and learn about my books that way. Celeste is the main brand. You'll find more information about me, the consulting work I do with aspiring and emerging authors, not craft, only business, because I taught craft for long enough and I don't really want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. Or you can find me on social media. You know, I tend to hang out more on Facebook than anywhere else. That's where my readership tends to be. Or you can Google me because I have a lot of books and I do come up. So, but yeah, Celeste Barkley is the easiest way to find me. CelesteBarkley.com.
All right. We'll have all those links in the show notes.
Yes, we will. So those will be at wishidknownforwriters.com. And if you want to support the podcast, you can go to that same link/support. And thanks to Alexa Larberg for doing the editing and producing, and to Adriel for doing all the admin. We will see everybody next week.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast. We hope this episode inspired you, empowered you, and made you laugh a little bit too. If you loved it, tell your friends about it. And if you feel so inclined, leave us a review. We look forward to being with you again next week.